Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Alice Bryant, Katie Weaver, Brian Lynn, and Dorothy Gundy. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Alice Bryant.
Rosa Gutierrez Lopez was frightened when immigration officials told her she had to leave the United States by December 10, 2018. The 40-year-old undocumented immigrant from El Salvador had been living in the U.S. since 2005. She lived in Northern Virginia, doing restaurant work and other jobs. She is the mother of three U.S. citizens. Gutierrez Lopez received deferred action by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, after she was detained in 2014 for being in the country illegally. Each year, she checked in with ICE, and her request for deferred action was granted. Her lawyer says the renewal was mainly granted because her young children are American citizens and one of them has a genetic disorder. In 2017, however, the first year of the Trump administration, Rosa noticed a difference when she reported to ICE for her yearly check-in. "I was told to report to a different location, and the official there began asking me all sorts of questions, questions they had never asked me before," she told VOA, speaking in Spanish. In the end, ICE did not renew her deferment. Officials ordered her to leave the country. She also had to wear an electronic device to record her movements. But then a friend told her about sanctuary Christian religious centers, and she was able to find one. Since mid-December, Gutierrez Lopez has been living at the Cedar Lane Unitarian Universalist Church in Bethesda, Maryland. She is the first publicly known case in the Washington, D.C. area since churches across the nation began resisting the Trump administration's immigration policies. While she lives in sanctuary, her lawyers are requesting her asylum because of high rates of organized crime in El Salvador. Criminal groups killed three of her close family members in recent years. Gutierrez Lopez fears the same will happen to her if she returns. Hector Perez Casillas is the immigration lawyer representing her. He believes she would be in serious danger if she returned to El Salvador.
They would be immediately targeted because they know that A, she's been here in the United States for so long, B, she has American children, and C, one of them is ill, making her an extra vulnerable target.
Gutierrez Lopez is one of 50 undocumented immigrants known to have sought sanctuary in 39 churches across the country. That information comes from the Church World Service, or CWS. While the total number of people now in sanctuary is unknown, the CWS notes there has been an increase since the start of the Trump administration. At that time, there were 37 reported cases. The number of churches offering sanctuary also rose from 400 in 2017 to more than 1,100 today. Noel Anderson is with the CWS. He says the Trump administration's policy of arresting and deporting undocumented immigrants who have no criminal records is responsible for the increase. The churches, in Anderson's words, see that people are being dehumanized. Though sanctuary churches may fear government raids, for now, immigration authorities are obeying the established tradition of staying out of churches, schools, and hospitals. Steve Camerota agrees with the tradition, but has strong criticism for the sanctuary movement. He is the research director at the Center for Immigration Studies, or CIS, an organization based in Washington, D.C.
It's understandable why in any individual case you might say, well, couldn't we make an exception for this nice guy, this nice lady? And I think everyone, feels a lot of sympathy for that. But when you do that, you end up with the scale of illegal immigration that we now have.
I'm Alice Bryant.
Historically, sailors called out the words, "Thar she blows," whenever they saw whales. Today, the old cry of sailors is taking on new meaning as scientists turn to modern technology to study whales. Some scientists have begun using drone aircraft, also known as unmanned aerial vehicles, to collect some of the fluids expelled by whales. Vanessa Parada is a researcher with Macquarie University in Sydney, Australia. She told the Reuters news agency that a drone has been used for the first time to collect whale mucus from humpback whales at sea. She believes that drones could help improve scientists' understanding of whales around the world. "We're collecting that visible plume of spray rising from the whale's blowhole as they come to the surface to breathe," she said. The method, she added, could provide a better understanding of the patterns and drivers of disease in wild populations. Parada was one of the writers of a paper on the use of drones to study whales. The paper appeared in the online publication Viruses. She and other scientists reported that they collected whale blow from 19 humpbacks during 2017. At the time, the whales were traveling northward from Antarctica to northern Australia. The report said the spray is collected in a small container connected to the top of a drone. The person operating the drone opens the container just as the aircraft flies above the whale. Parada described the new method as less invasive than using a boat to get close enough to collect fluids. "And it is better than methods that depend on killing whales or on whales that are trapped." The whale spray collected by a drone contains DNA, the carrier of genetic information, proteins, and different kinds of bacteria. Parada said her team can collect bacteria that lives in a whale's lungs to measure whale health. In this way, drones serve as an early warning system of possible changes in whales' health. An international ban on whaling took effect in 1986, but Japan announced last year that it would restart commercial whaling this July in its waters and restricted economic area. I'm Katie Weaver.
The European Commission has ordered a recall of a smartwatch for children because of what it calls a serious privacy risk. The watch, called SafeKid 1, is a product of the German electronics manufacturer Enux. The company sells other smartwatch models, as well as televisions and wireless communication devices. On its website, Enux describes the SafeKid 1 as a tool for parents. The watches have a simple, colorful design that seems appealing to children. The device has a built-in microphone and speaker to permit two-way communication. The company says the smartwatch can be used by parents to learn where their children are at all times and contact them. It says this can be done with a computer software program or app. The Enux website says children wearing the watch can place a telephone call with just one touch of a number. The site claims that only pre-listed parties can call a child through the device.
However, the European Commission, EC, recently reported that it found major security concerns with the SafeKid 1 system. The EC is the decision-making body of the European Union, EU. The warning was made public through the EC's Rapid Alert System. Commission members investigated the device after concerns were reported by officials in Iceland. The EC wrote that the risk level of the smartwatches was serious and called for an immediate recall of the devices. The warning said the app linked to the SafeKid 1 device can permit non-secure communications with the system's computer server. The server's security issues make it possible for people to break into the system and steal private information, the EC said. As a result, data such as location history, phone numbers, and serial number can be easily retrieved and changed, it warned. A malicious user can send commands to any watch, making it call another number of his choosing, can communicate with the child wearing the device, or locate the child through GPS, the warning said.
The European Commission said the privacy and security risks led to its decision to announce an immediate recall of the devices from EU members. EC officials said the SafeKid 1 was being sold on the internet. The founder of Enux, Ole Anton Bjeltved, spoke to the British Broadcasting Corporation about the EC's decision. He said the device had met all German government rules last year before being offered to the public. He added that the version of the smartwatch tested by the EC was no longer being sold. Enux plans to appeal the recall decision. It is not the first time privacy and security concerns have been raised about smartwatches for children. In 2017, German officials banned some kinds of smartwatches. The government said the watches let parents secretly listen in to children and their environment. At the time, no specific smartwatches were named. Officials said the devices had microphones that let parents listen in on teachers and school activities. The government said the system violated German laws aimed at restricting surveillance. Also in 2017, a Norwegian Consumer Council report warned of the dangers of smartwatches for children. The group said it had uncovered serious security and privacy issues after examining and testing several smartwatch models being sold across Europe. The report said that in a few simple steps, a stranger could easily take control of the watches to be able to find, listen to, and communicate with a child. At the time, the council said there was an urgent need for manufacturers to increase security of the systems or face forced recalls of the devices. I'm Brian Lynn.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Years of disagreement between the North and the South finally burst into civil war in April of 1861. Seven states in the South had withdrawn from the Union. Soldiers of the new Confederate States of America shelled the Union base at Fort Sumter, built on an island in Charleston Harbor in South Carolina. They captured Fort Sumter after 2 days. President Abraham Lincoln asked the states of the Union for 75,000 soldiers to help end the Southern Rebellion. Northern states quickly sent forces to Washington. But border states, those between the North and the South, refused to send any. Some prepared to leave the Union and join the Confederacy. Steve Ember and Shirley Griffith describe the first days of the American Civil War.
The first state to secede after the start of the Civil War was Virginia. It was an important state because of its location. It was just across the Potomac River from Washington. Virginia's decision to secede cost the Union a military commander of great ability. He was Robert E. Lee. Lee was a Virginian and had served in the United States Army for more than 30 years. Lincoln asked him to be head of the Army when General Winfield Scott retired. Lee said he could not accept the job. He said he opposed secession and loved the Union. But, he said, he could not make war on his home state. Lee resigned from the Army. He did not really want to fight at all. But soon after his resignation, he agreed to command the forces of Virginia.
Virginia's forces moved quickly after the state seceded. A group of 1,000 soldiers went to Harper's Ferry, Virginia, where the Union Army had a gun factory and arsenal. It was the same town where abolitionist John Brown had tried to start a slave rebellion a few years before. The United States force at Harper's Ferry was small. The soldiers could not defend the town against the Virginians, so they left. Before marching away, the soldiers set fire to the gun factory and arsenal. The fire did not destroy all the equipment at the gun factory. When the Virginians captured the town, they sent the equipment south, where it was used to make guns for Confederate soldiers.
Virginia's forces also moved against the United States' biggest Navy base, which was at Norfolk, Virginia. Once again, the Union force withdrew. Before leaving, it burned every building and sank every ship. President Lincoln was becoming increasingly worried about Virginia's military moves. He was afraid Confederate forces in Virginia might try to capture Washington in the first days of the war. After all, the Confederate Secretary of War had declared that the Confederate flag would fly over the Capitol building before the 1st of May. Washington was not strongly defended. It did not have enough soldiers to stop any real attempt by Confederate forces to seize the city. It was extremely important to get more soldiers to Washington as quickly as possible.
Thousands of men were on their way to Washington, but they could not get there quickly. Troop trains had to pass through the state of Maryland to get to Washington from the north. Many people in the state supported the Confederacy. The governor, however, did not. He refused to call a meeting of the state legislature. He was afraid it might vote to secede. He wanted to keep Maryland neutral. The first troop train from the north passed through Baltimore, Maryland, without incident. The second train was not so lucky. A mob blocked the rail line and threw stones at the train. Shots were fired. 4 soldiers and 12 civilians were killed. State and city officials met to discuss the trouble. They agreed that there would be even more violence in the future. So they ordered railroad bridges outside Baltimore destroyed. No more trains from the north could reach Washington that way.
President Lincoln told the officials of the great need to get more soldiers to the Capitol. He agreed that they did not have to pass through Baltimore. But he wanted them to be able to land safely at Annapolis, a city on the Chesapeake Bay. Landing at Annapolis would be easy. Getting to the Capitol would not. Supporters of the Confederacy had damaged trains, rail lines, and bridges between the two cities. The first soldiers to land at Annapolis had to repair everything as they moved ahead. Still, with all these difficulties, 10,000 troops made it to Washington in the first few weeks of the Civil War. The city and government were safe.
President Lincoln worried about the presence of Confederate supporters in Maryland. He knew they would continue to be a threat to the movement of Union troops and supplies. Lincoln wanted to restrict the activities of the Confederate supporters, so he took an extremely unusual step for an American president. He put much of Maryland under military rule. He gave military officers the power to arrest civilians believed to be hostile to the Union. and he gave them the power to hold these suspects without trial. This order suspended two of the basic rights under the Constitution. One was the right to go free until officially charged, and the other was the right to a speedy trial. The Chief Justice of the United States wrote a letter to President Lincoln. He said the Constitution did not give the President the power to suspend the rights of citizens. Lincoln disagreed. He felt the situation facing the Union permitted him to take such strong measures. If he had not acted, he believed, Maryland would have seceded.
Maryland did not withdraw, but North Carolina, Tennessee, and Arkansas did. There were now 11 states in the Confederacy. There could be two more. No one knew how long Kentucky and Missouri would remain in the Union. Both supported the Southern rebels. President Lincoln treated Kentucky carefully. He did not want the state to secede, nor did he want it to remain neutral. Kentucky reached from the mountains of Virginia to the Mississippi River. As a neutral state, Kentucky could block Northern troops from much of the South. Lincoln wanted it firmly on the side of the Union. The president did not use force in Kentucky as he had done in Maryland. Instead, he sent people to Kentucky to organize support for the Union. Newspapers were urged to publish pro-Union statements. Home Guard forces were formed. They received their weapons and supplies from Lincoln's administration. Lincoln hoped that in time, these efforts would win Kentucky's support for his war effort.
In Missouri, the governor tried hard to take the state out of the Union. He called a convention to decide the question. A majority of the delegates refused to vote for secession. The governor organized state soldiers. The Lincoln administration organized Home Guard forces. The two sides clashed several times. Some civilians were killed. The United States Army finally seized government buildings in the state capital. They forced state officials, including the governor, to flee. Missouri would remain in the Union.
The capital of the Confederate States of America was located far south in Montgomery, Alabama. Within the first few weeks of the Civil War, the Confederate Congress voted to move the capital farther north to Richmond, Virginia. They believed Virginia would be an important battlefield in the war. They were right. 2 days before Confederate President Jefferson Davis left for Richmond, Union troops invaded Virginia. They left Washington, crossed the Potomac River, and seized the towns of Arlington and Alexandria. No shots were fired. Confederate forces withdrew as Union troops moved forward. Within a month, thousands more Union soldiers were in Virginia. They were to prepare for a major battle at a place called Manassas Junction, or Bull Run.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.